The UN says that humanity stands on the brink of catastrophic man-made climate change. But is it true?
Not a chance. But we do stand on the brink of catastrophic government policies that threaten to ruin the nation our forefathers built and defended against tyranny.
So what drives the climate scare, Jay?
Besides simple ignorance, the scare is driven by corporate greed and the desire of government to control all aspects of our lives, Tom.
Is this part of something more sinister?
Indeed it is. Whether it's climate change or a pandemic or socialism, it really means sacrificing your rights and accepting the tyranny of the fourth branch of government, the bureaucracy. It must be stopped.
This is The Other Side of the Story with Dr. Jay Lair and Tom Harris of the International Climate Science Coalition.
We often hear from environmental groups that radiation is always dangerous, no matter what. For example, on the Greenpeace website, it says this, quote, "With Fukushima, we once again all witnessed the horror of another nuclear accident. Like Chernobyl, hundreds and thousands of families had to be evacuated overnight as their homes were no longer safe. Nuclear radiation was spreading every minute, contaminating everything on its way," unquote. What do you think of that, Jay?
Well, I think Greenpeace and others are largely responsible for 1,600 people who died after Fukushima, not at all from radiation, but from the radiation scare. They moved about 5,000 elderly people 7 miles away and put them in poor living conditions. And the stress of that move, they estimated 1,600 additional premature deaths than would have occurred had the people not left the Fukushima area. I had just finished a book which was on nuclear radiation, published about the same month as Fukushima, and all the network TV people found the book and saw me as an expert and asked me. I did 23 network television shows, and after the first one on CNN, they found anti-nuke people to sit next to me and tell the public that I was crazy, saying what I said, which was the tragedy there was just that the four nuclear plants would probably be shut down and not work, but it wasn't a health problem. Because the amount of radiation that would escape from the nuclear power plants being shut off would be mixed with the winds, and there should be absolutely no one gets sick from radiation. But the scare went on for 3 years, and I actually got death threats from people telling the opposite of Greenpeace, which is, of course, true. Now, I've been involved with low-dose radiation for maybe even more years than Dr. Jerry Cutler, who will join us soon, because I wrote an article on radiation fear almost 50 years ago, and a man by the name of Walter Hybe wrote me and said he'd written a book about it. It was 1,000 pages long and had hundreds of examples of the fact that low-level ionizing radiation is not a threat. And so the sad part is that we have a whole field of nuclear medicine with a marvelous track record of saving lives that has been impeded by this unnecessary fear.
Yeah. Well, so in fact, did anybody die in Fukushima from radiation?
No, nobody died. Nobody got sick. Two people died in the plant from falling off a ladder, actually. There has been zero radiation illness from the Fukushima disaster for the very reason I said. The amount of radiation that escaped when the plant couldn't be cooled with the winds off the coast just went down to levels that nobody was injured. And the United States didn't want people move 7 miles. They wanted people move 12 miles. And they had fear stories about radioactive materials washing up on the California, Oregon, and Washington state coast for some very long time. It's really terrible to see how organizations like Greenpeace and others can strike fear into the public that has an incredible negative impact.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess some of the environmentalists would say, oh, well, nobody died because we evacuated them. If we hadn't evacuated anybody, you think anybody would have died?
I think nobody would have died, absolutely. And I have not read that position, Tom, but you're absolutely right. They could say that. You know, when we don't have storms or terrible things happening, the global warming people will say, oh, it's because we've warned people about all these terrible things. Yeah, the leftist anti-science people will always find a theme regardless of the facts.
Yeah, yeah, it reminds me of a joke, hey, where they have a huge dog in the bottom of their garden to scare away the fairies. And somebody says, well, there are no fairies. And I say, see, it works.
Yeah, yeah, that is a very good analogy to what they do.
Yeah, well, our guest today is Dr. Jerry Cutler. Since 1995, Dr. Cutler has been collaborating with renowned medical scientists in many studies on the health effects of ionizing radiation and has authored or co-authored more than 70 articles, mostly in peer-reviewed journals. He's gathered, assessed, and communicated evidence of radiation-induced beneficial health effects, which is going to be interesting to hear about. When the COVID-19 issue started last year, Dr. Cutler wrote to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration urging the initiation of a small clinical trial on the efficacy of administering low doses of x-rays to the lungs of patients with acute respiratory distress syndrome. And by the way, I looked it up, acute respiratory distress syndrome. It's a serious lung condition that causes low blood oxygen. The FDA obviously listened to Dr. Cutler as more than 15 clinical trials on this controversial therapy began in different countries. So we'll ask him about the results of that to date. Now, Dr. Cutler, he was president of the Canadian Nuclear Society from 95 to 96, and he was employed by Atomic Energy of Canada from 1974 to 2000, in which he was working on the design, construction, and operation of about 25 CANDU reactors in Canada and overseas. For the past 20 years, he's been supplying technical services to clients and participating in the activities of about 10 professional organizations. He's a Canadian, a University of Toronto engineering physics graduate, which I'm happy to hear. He received his Master's of Science and Doctorate of Science degrees in nuclear sciences at the Israel Institute of Technology. So welcome to the show, Dr. Cutler.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Jerry, when did you first recognize what level or part of your career that low-level radiation could be used positively in medicine? What was the beginning for you?
There was an anniversary, centennial, in 1995. It was 100 years after Röntgen discovered X-rays, and the ANS, American Nuclear Society, had they have a summer meeting, annual meeting, and a winter meeting in November. So the November meeting was in San Francisco, and they had a lecture to commemorate, centennial lecture, and it was given by Dr. Myron Polykov, who was professor and head of nuclear medicine at the San Francisco General Hospital. And so he came and gave this talk about the discovery and how radiation, X-rays, and nuclear radiation is being used for 100 years. And in his talk, he pointed out that low doses of radiation were stimulatory, were beneficial. And there's actually a threshold at which it becomes harmful when you get a high dose, and below that, the exposure is beneficial.
Jerry, it's generally called, through modern literature, hormesis. And I think very few people, few of our listeners who may have an idea that low-level ionizing or low-dose ionizing radiation has positive impacts in health. I'm not sure many of them are familiar with the term hormesis, or really it's even a good thing that we have this term, and maybe we shouldn't have it, and we should just be constantly talking about low-dose ionizing radiation. When did you first come across the term hormesis?
Well, I was reading books by Don Lucky, and he used that in the title of the books. And someone coined the word, I think he was a biologist in the log industry. There is a condition in trees in which the chemical actually stimulates, low doses stimulates tree growth, and high doses are harmful. Mm-hmm. Now, the word hormesis, it comes from the Greek word to excite, and the word hormone. When you take hormones, you stimulate your protection systems, and the hormesis is related to that word. The problem mm-hmm. is that people have been taught that hormesis is, they've been taught that radiation is harmful and that exposures are very harmful. They cause cancer and mutations. And so some people are afraid to use the H word because it conjures up negative terms. And so I use it occasionally, but I try to avoid it because whenever people hear that word, they don't recognize it, and they think it's snake oil. So
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it's better that we just say what it is, low-dose ionizing radiation. In fact, let me stop right there. Using the word ionizing, could you explain why that is part of the term, low-level ionizing radiation? Is there non-ionizing radiation?
Well, yes, if you get to electromagnetic waves, of course, you have radio waves and even waves coming off your 60 hertz power lines. But when you get to higher frequency, there's more energy involved in each photon that comes off of that radiation. And when you get to high energies, you can actually separate electrons from atoms, and that's ionizing them. So the radiation you get from a cell phone, the microwaves, people think that's causing cancer, but it's really producing a bit of heat, but nothing more. It's when you get to higher doses that you actually separate electrons, and then you cause ions, and then that's why it's called ionizing radiation. When the radiation frequency is high enough that it breaks off electrons, and people are concerned about that because for example, ionizing radiation is considered to damage biomolecules. And I'll tell you where a lot of it happens. We inhale oxygen, and the oxygen forms a reactive oxygen species. Our body uses these for redox signaling. Every organism needs these redox signaling. They use reactive oxygen species, which your body produces for normal signaling, but these radicals, which are ions, they damage biomolecules. So normally your DNA is being damaged continually as a side effect of redox signaling. And so your body has enormously powerful protection systems, and they produce antioxidants, which prevent the oxidative damage, stress from these reactive oxygen species, these ions.
Jerry, you're talking about high levels. I don't want our listeners to get scared.
This is normal biology, your normal day-to-day breathing of air.
Right. But it's not what we're talking about getting down to a lower level and using it medically, is it?
Well, no. We're mixing two things. Your body is producing ions as part of your signaling, and you also get ions produced by X-rays and the nuclear radiation is coming from outside, and there's also radiation coming from the environment, and it's coming from space. The thing is, our body produces a lot more damage naturally just from our normal living than what's caused by external and internal radiation. So you have radioisotopes in your body. For example, you have potassium, which has potassium-40 isotope. So you get radiation coming in externally and also internally. And the level of that is minuscule compared to the damage that's being done by your normal oxidative damage. It's because of the redox signaling. So
that's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
So you have an enormous amount of damage being done to your DNA just with normal living. And you have enormous protection systems that produce antioxidants. They produce repair of DNA damage, and they also removal of damaged DNA. Cells commit suicide when they're damaged, or your immune system removes cells that aren't adequately repaired.
So are you drawing
you have enormous protection systems, and what's coming from outside is negligible. It's laughable.
All right. Well, are you drawing a parallel between what your body does in repairing itself with internal radiation to the work you do on the outside with low dose radiation aimed at curing illness? I mean, are you seeing is there a parallel there?
Well, that's the same sort of effect. If you have radiation coming from outside, there's two things that happen. First, you can hit your DNA and cause direct breakage of the bonds, or you can ionize, the radiation can ionize the water. Our bodies are, I don't know, 60 to 80% water. And that breaks into hydrogen and ions and hydroxyl ions, OH negative. And these reactive oxygen species, they damage your cells. So you get the damage caused by outside radiation, but that's normally very, very small compared to the damage that your own body does as part of your redox signaling that your body has to do in order to communicate.
Wow. And I guess as humans evolved, they were in an environment that had radiation. From granite,
yes, and they adapted to it, of course. But what I'm saying is, you have enormous protection systems that are extremely powerful, just for your own internal damage that's being produced. And so the stuff that's coming from outside is trivial in comparison. So why people are getting so excited about outside radiation when your body is accustomed to dealing with 1,000 times more?
Well, I can answer that question, Jerry. The reason people are worried about it is because there are organizations that focus on this problem of radiation. They scare people into giving them money. Fear is what controls society.
Yeah, but it goes back way before then. I mean, they were doing studies on X-rays back in the 1920s, and Hermann Muller did some studies to try and change fruit flies, modify them, eugenics. And he thought he was causing mutations, but he was giving so much radiation, they were actually breaking the cells in pieces, not just damaging them. So they produced a model, a linear model that related the mutations to X-ray exposure dose. This was a total fiction, because we have thresholds where when you get an exposure above a certain level, it becomes harmful and damaging. And below it, the exposure is actually stimulating, because what a low dose does is quite remarkable. As I explained, we have protection systems which are dealing with our normal damage that's happening. And when you get a small dose of radiation from outside, those protection systems go in the high gear. What happens is you produce a little bit of damage, then your body, your protection systems react. And not only do they repair the damage that was caused by your radiation exposure, they overreact and they produce more benefit. They overshoot, you understand what I mean.
Yeah,
and so you
do
an actual benefit effect because your protection systems over-responded.
That explanation is really awesome. Our good friend Ed Calabrese has spent almost his entire professional life trying to debunk Mueller's work back in the 20s and have things change and do away with the low dose, no threshold model. And I believe, when did you and Ed get together? I know you've co-authored a paper not long ago.
Well, I got to know Ed just before year 2000, 1998 or so. I met him at some conferences, and Myron Polykov, the fellow gave that lecture celebrating the centennial of discovery of X-rays. He introduced me to Ed Calabrese, and he's been having conferences, and he has a society, the Dose Response Society, and we used to have conferences I used to go to, and I collaborate with him for 20 years producing papers on the subject. But there's one thing I need to tell you about that really people don't know about. And that was after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki to end the World War II, Dwight Eisenhower came out with Atoms for Peace speech, and he created the International Atomic Energy Agency, and he was promoting the idea of taking nuclear energy and making electricity and providing enormous benefit. Now, this threatened the oil industry, and the Rockefeller Foundation got very concerned about the enormous shift from fossil energy that they were supplying to nuclear energy. And so the foundation stimulated or took, they managed actually the NAS, the National Academy of Sciences, the U.S. one. And they did studies to try and create this scare of radiation. So they took the ideas that Muller had of a linear relationship between radiation dose and mutations, and they tried to change the model that they use for the effect of radiation on health from a threshold, which it is, to a linear model, and then create a scare that any exposure down to zero will cause mutations. And it went farther than that. They brought in another professor from California. His name was Ed Lewis, and he did a study on radiation from Hiroshima, the fallout, well, the actual survivors of the bombing. And he did a study trying to relate leukemia, cancer, to radiation exposure. And he tried to produce a straight line and convince everyone that not only did the radiation cause mutations, it also caused his cancer. And so it was the oil industry, I think, that stimulated a lot of the fear about radiation effects. And that would, and it did, in fact, affect production of nuclear energy.
I absolutely did not know that. It makes all the sense in the world. The oil industry is doing more of that sort of thing. They're all in favor of scaring people with climate change, because that raises the price of oil, while the climate change alarmists want to get rid of oil. They're really not doing it. They're just limiting the supply. The price goes up in the oil industry.
Well, what they're doing is they're promoting the renewables. These are the windmills and the
solar panels. They know they're promoting them, but they know they can't work. And
well,
that,
no, they know that they're unreliable, so they're burning a lot of oil to fill in the gap when the
that's exactly right. Tom and I have had a number of shows
They push windmills and solar panels to deflect nuclear energy, because if you tell them that these are renewable and they're emission free, then they know that they will supply the oil that will fill in the unavailability.
You're
Whereas
exactly
nuclear
right.
Nuclear energy cannot fill in those gaps. So I think it's a Trojan horse, renewables, to keep fossil energy supplying the majority of the energy that world needs.
No question. Yeah.
Well, that's a good place to go for our break. When we come back after the break, Dr. Cutler, can we talk about some of the testing and experiments that you've done showing the benefits of low levels of radiation? We'll be right back after the break.
I'm excited to talk about a new product from HealthyCell, AC11. This is a patented bioactive extract of Uncaria tomentosa from the Amazon rainforest. It supports cell DNA repair and health span. It's a dietary supplement. I'm excited to try it. Many are interested in longevity and attenuation of senescence. We know that telomere length and other biologic measures are related to senescence in clinical and preclinical studies, particularly of animal models. And I can tell you as a doctor, dietary supplements do hold the promise of attenuating repair and damage in our body due to stress, physical wear and tear, sunlight, etc. And there's a tremendous opportunity for supplements to help us in this area. And so HealthyCell has brought a product to market for you to try as part of your health portfolio. So please go to HealthyCell.com and in the promotional code, list out loud for 20% off your first purchase of products from HealthyCell. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Because of COVID-19, many Americans worry about their health four times a day. That's 112 times per month. But by simply keeping our immune system strong, we can stay healthy and put our worries at ease. One little known way to do this is by taking AC11, a patented supplement from a plant in the Amazon rainforest. Studied for over 20 years and backed by over 40 scientific peer-reviewed studies, taking AC11 has been proven to extend the life of immune cells called leukocytes, allowing you to boost immunity naturally. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of AC11. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
While the cancel culture is determined to destroy our history, bringing violence and terror to city streets, America Out Loud will enhance its own message of love and honor for the American traditions and constitutional values that have always been the backbone of what America means: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. America Out Loud Talk Radio, liberty and justice for all.
Dr. Cutler, can you tell us about some of your work to actually assess whether or not low-level radiation helps with, for example, Alzheimer's disease?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that. I'd been writing papers up until 2015, and I still am, about health effects of radiation from other people's work. But a funny thing happened in April 2015. A colleague of mine who'd been reading my articles said, look, I have a problem. My wife, I just put her in hospice. She's got Alzheimer's. She's had it for 10 years and she's going to die soon. Is there anything we can do to save her life? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I'll tell you, I read a paper a year ago on how low doses of radiation stimulate recovery from neurodegenerative disease and Alzheimer's. And I sent him the paper and he said, well, what should we do? And I said, well, we'd like to do half body radiation for your wife to see if that she'll recover. And of course, he talked with the doctor, her physician, and he says, there's no way I can prescribe that sort of thing. So the two of them, the husband and the doctor, discussed it. And they said, what about a CT scan of her brain? We said, well, I can prescribe that. We can.
Yeah.
She's dying and we want to study her brain and see if we can stimulate it. Let's do it. So he gets a prescription and he goes to the radiologist, and the radiologist says it's going to cost you $4,000. And he said, how come so much? And he said, well, someone has to read the image, the scan. And he says, well, I'm not interested in the scan. Just give me the radiation. So that turned out to be $75, which he pulled out of his wallet and paid him right on the spot, because that's this sort of thing wasn't covered by insurance. Mm-hmm. So a remarkable thing happened. He brought her back to the hospice, and the next day, the caregiver goes to the supervisor and says, "I've never seen anything like this. Our patient, Barbara Moore, she's made a recovery. She's talking, she's eating. I mean, she'd been a vegetable until then.
Wow.
And she's moving out of her wheelchair a bit." And so he calls me back, the husband, the next day, and he says, "You won't believe what's happened." I said, she's good.
Wow.
She's made a big improvement. So I said, "Well, you got to be careful. This isn't going to last very long. So try and get additional treatments." I suggested get two of them a week, CT scans. And so he goes to the doctor and says, "Well, can I get the script for some more?" And he says, "Well, I'm not going to do it twice a week, but how about every 2 weeks?" So he said, "Okay, I'll take it." So we ended up giving her a total of four treatments. The first treatment she got actually was a double scan. It was funny. When she was getting the first scan, she moved. And the operator thought, "Well, I can't use this image, so I'll give her a second one." So she ended up on the first treatment getting a double scan, and then the other two treatments were single scans. They sent her out of the hospice back to a senior's home with a daycare program. So she made a good recovery. She wasn't perfect, but she was a lot better than being a vegetable in a hospice. So,
but that was 5 years ago. What kind of continued research on Alzheimer's has been performed since?
Well, it's more than that. After the husband saw this exposure, the benefit, he has Parkinson's disease. So he went to the doctor and he said, "Well, I've got a neurodegenerative disease. Maybe this will help me." So he got the doctor to give him a prescription for him. And the next day, the day he got the treatment, when he went to bed, the tremors stopped. Soon he stopped cutting.
Oh,
he cut the dose of levodopa that he was taking, the pills. He was taking six a day, and he cut it down to three a day. And so anyhow, we ended up treating Barbara for several years, and she died after 3 years. And in 2016, her quality of life was really good. She was driving. She wasn't driving. She was with her husband going out for excursions, and he'd bring her back to the senior's home. And then eventually the treatment didn't work after a year or so. In 2017, she started to deteriorate. In 2018, in April, she died. And Eugene Moore still has his Parkinson, and he's still getting treatments. And whenever he feels run down, he gets prescriptions and he gets more treatments, and he's feeling a lot better.
Wow.
So what happened was, this has all happened in Midland, Michigan. So I come back to Toronto and I go to the local hospital. Well, not a local hospital. It's Baycrest. It's a renowned center for neurodegenerative diseases, Alzheimer's. And they have a lot of patients there in the hospital, Apotex Hospital. And there's the Baycrest Sciences Center. I keep coming there and I keep asking him to repeat the treatments that we gave in Michigan. He thought it was a bit crazy, but then when I showed him the papers and the pictures of the patient eating her food and looking at the camera when I asked her to pose, he said, "Well, what do you need?" And I said, "Well, let's repeat it on three patients. We'll do three treatments, but the patients have to be severe cases, because I don't want to work with someone who's early stage and has good days and bad days, because you can't get repeatable results." So we ended up, I actually treated five patients. I brought them from Baycrest doesn't have X-ray CT scanner. So I had to take them to Sunnybrook Hospital. So we had to set up a clinical trial. We had to go through ethics board. It took a year to get approvals. And I had to get approval from Health Canada to use a CT scanner for treatment, because they were designed and licensed for imaging.
Yeah.
And the head of radiology didn't want to get in trouble using a machine inappropriately. So the Health Canada judged that this was off-label use of a machine, but since it was a safe treatment, and especially since we're doing it with an ethics board approval in big hospitals, they approved it. Mm-hmm. They accepted it. So we ended up treating the five patients. Four of them got significantly better. One of them was a real far gone case, 90 years old, and we had to move her with a Hoyer lift from the bed to wheelchair. So that treatment didn't work much on that, didn't work at all on that patient. But the other four, they're remarkable. The family members came and it was day and night. The patient began, one of them began to walk a bit, being held by the hand. The others were talking, telling jokes.
So what are you doing now? I mean, is there a future?
So what happened was I wrote a paper and I went through, it took me a year to get it published, went through peer review, and I got a lot of three rounds of peer review with major changes for the first two and minor changes for the third. But I got the paper published and it got publicity. Baycrest put out a newsletter and suddenly people started calling the hospital asking for treatments for their relatives mm-hmm. who were in hospice. Well, in the home, a lot of them were far advanced. So Apotex Foundation, which built the hospital there, they gave us $1 million to do more studies because people were asking for it. And Baycrest says, well, gee, we only did a pilot here. We can't do much with this.
So is it ongoing now?
So what we did is we're now doing, we're treating 40 patients, 20 treated and 20 controlled. And this is randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled patients. It started in November of this year. So
that
nobody
is
knows
exciting.
Who's being treated. They think I'm a biased investigator, so they brought in an independent group of a contractor to do the whole study, and they're doing a lot of tests, not just, talking with relatives, but they're doing... markers and they're measuring.
This is really, Jerry, this is so exciting. Are you, Tom and I had a nuclear physicist on our show some weeks back from South Africa, and he told us something very exciting, that they're a leader in nuclear medicine, and that in a nearby airport from the hospital he works at, there's a plane taking off every hour to go somewhere in the world with time sensitive nuclear medicine, and he had numbers of the lives they saved. And Tom and I were surprised that we were not familiar with what was going on in South Africa and the work that Kelvin Cam had done. We were more familiar with the work he was doing in promoting nuclear power in South Africa. Have you heard, or are you familiar with the work they're doing in South Africa?
Well, of course they did it in South Africa, but Canada was a world leader. We were producing Moly-99, which is being used for imaging, and we make a lot of cobalt-60 in Canada in our reactors, which are used for treating cancer with high-dose radiation, and we're using a multitude of isotopes. We're also producing a new isotope, actinium-225, which they will tag onto, it's an alpha emitter, and they're going to tag it onto a ligand, and they'll be able to inject it in a patient, and it'll go to tumors, and the short-range alpha particles will destroy the cancer cells, it's not going to reach healthy tissue, healthy cells, because the range of the radiation is very, very short. It just destroys the cells themselves. So
there's
a lot of this being done. Of course, America is using a lot of nuclear medicine. And the fellow who gave the lecture at the Centennial, Myron Polykov, was using radiation, radioisotopes, and also treatments with X-rays. But
how is the false
dose
model,
treatments?
How has the linear no-dose threshold model, which the government keeps supporting with no science validity whatsoever, how, if at all, is it impeding work in Canada?
Well, I had a lot of trouble using low doses for stimulating protection systems. Took a long time to get through ethics committee to use the CT scans to stimulate protection systems in the patient to produce recovery from Alzheimer's. You see, the problem I mentioned, the oxidative damage that's happening enormous rate in every human due to redox signaling. Well, when a patient gets old, the protection systems that were dealing with that get weaker. And so your cells degenerate, and the neurodegenerative diseases, among many other diseases, cancer included, they all become a disease of old people. And so we can treat a lot of these diseases with low doses of radiation, but the medical profession shun any application of low doses in medicine because they've been taught from 1960 the radiation causes cancer, and there's no benefit from low doses. Mm-hmm. And so it's a real struggle to get these treatments, these studies approved to do. You know, we had a lot of these studies were done before 1960, but when they produced that health scare after the bombing of Hiroshima, of radiation fallout and low dose fear, you see, it's perfectly permissible to kill cells with radiation, but to stimulate protection systems, that's forbidden. Because, so that's the irony. You're allowed to kill cells with radiation, but you're not allowed to stimulate protection systems with low doses.
You know, I think some listeners probably have Parkinson's. I know my mother did for 20 years before she passed away. And of course, lots of people have Alzheimer's. When do you think these kinds of treatments will be available to the average person as a matter of course?
Well, I have to finish the study we're doing in Toronto, and then we'll have to do more studies because people are skeptical that this idea works. It was very difficult in the hospital to even get patients nominated or to be treated, mm-hmm. because the physicians thought I was crazy. Trying to treat Alzheimer's with low doses of X-ray CT scans. Even though the papers I showed them and the evidence, they still didn't believe it.
Yeah, so we're a few years off yet before it's a general treatment anyway.
Yeah, well, it's going to take a long time. There's other diseases. Parkinson is, I've treated a couple of patients with that. But there's an enormous number of neurodegenerative diseases that can be treated with low dose of radiation. And then we got to talk about autoimmune diseases. And there's 80 of those that could be treated with low doses of radiation, which are being shunned.
Yeah, I would hope that Parkinson's Society, the Alzheimer's Societies, I hope they're paying attention, because I know my dad did quite a lot of research on Parkinson's when my mom caught it. And it was very depressing. There didn't seem to be any progress towards a solution, but it sounds like I hope they're paying attention.
Well, I contacted the Alzheimer's Association in Chicago back in 2016, right after I treated that patient, my colleague in Midland, and I suggested they do a study. And they came back to me and said, well, give us a plan and we'll look at funding it. And there was no way I could produce any sort of a plan to do a study, because you need a hospital, you need ethics approval. You just can't do it. Mm-hmm. So they were prepared to fund me, but I couldn't produce a proposal for a study. Mm-hmm. And it's only my determination to get that little pilot done in Toronto in 2016. 17, we actually started it, and I finished it. And took me 4 years to finish it. And wow. Now we've started this larger study, which started November 1st. And I think that's going to be done a lot faster because people are interested in this.
Yeah, well, I'll bet there are tens of millions of people who are saying, let's get this going.
Well, there's a lot of people don't believe it, especially the physicians.
Mm-hmm.
They've been taught and they shun that whole idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were trying to treat COVID-19 with a low-dose x-ray to the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
And we had problem in the Institutional Review Board, IRB, or the Ethics Committee, getting mm-hmm. approval to do studies on these patients, the COVID-19 people that were going into ICU.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We got 15 studies were done, but it was a real battle to get them done. And it was done not by the FDA. It was individual radiation oncologists decided they were going to get these studies done.
Mm-hmm. And when you say the doctors present opposition, are they actually teaching the low dose, no threshold model in
of
medical
course.
Schools?
Yeah, the textbook for radiologists is a book that's written by people who are strong believers of the linear model. So everyone who gets taught about radiation learns that it's any amount is harmful and it can only be used in high doses to kill cells, and you can't use it for treating cells.
Yeah, that's really sad because, I mean, everybody knows that vitamins at certain levels are healthy, and you take too much selenium, of course, it's a problem. I mean, you can even kill somebody by forcing them to drink too much water, I understand.
Oh, yes, so, everything has a threshold.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's the dose that makes the poison.
Yeah, who is it that says that?
I can't remember his name. I'm almost 80 years old myself, so I have problems remembering names.
Parcellus, and it was sometime in the 15th century.
Parcellus.
Yes. But a very, back. Yeah. There have been books written, The Dose Makes the Poison. There was
well,
a book
let
written.
Let me tell you the interesting problem. Ed Calabrese is a toxicologist, but his whole field of toxicology was damaged by the radiation scare that was produced by the oil industry to stop nuclear energy. Because once they started this linear model, they applied it not only to radiation, they applied it to chemicals. So now pharmaceutical, the whole toxicology business is damaged because the idea of a threshold is not there anymore. People are looking at running the hazard all the way down to zero dose. So you have problems.
Well, let me tell you, I'll tell you a funny
in water and everywhere else in air.
Yeah. I'll tell you a funny Ed Calabrese story. When the tsunami hit in March of 2011, CNN, looking for a radiation expert, found my book on nuclear power that had come out the same month. And they were able to locate me within an hour of the tsunami. And they asked me if I would come to their studio and be a guest. And I was about an hour away from their studio. Since it was about radiation, they were asking me, and I was very comfortable with it. I said I would, even though at that moment I knew nothing about the tsunami. I had an hour drive. My wife was with me. She drove. And I did all the research on the tsunami and the nuclear power plants. And I decided in the car, I'll call Ed Calabrese and check with him everything I was going to say, because I knew he had spent many more years studying the issue. So I had a conversation with him, and it turns out everything I thought was the case, that it wouldn't be a radiation poisoning problem and people wouldn't get sick. And when we finished the conversation, he said, Jay, you've got it all right, but I'm sure glad you're going to say it, not me, because he knew the opposition would come to me.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about Calabrese is he had to deal with the radiation problem in order to deal with his toxicology problem. Because if you can debunk the scare on radiation, then the toxicology problem becomes less of a problem. You got to establish that there's a threshold, below it is beneficial and above it is harmful. Mm-hmm. And once you do that for radiation, you can do it for chemicals.
Mm-hmm. I should just alert listeners to the fact that there's actually a program, a new GoFundMe campaign to raise money for a lawsuit to end the use of the linear no threshold model. And in fact, if people do a quick search, it's GoFundMe, it's Help Sue the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to End the Use of the LNT Model. That's the linear no threshold model. And I'll just read a quote from Dr. Bennett Greenspan. He says, "We believe the NRC denied the petitions illegally, and we have a certain amount of time to sue and to force the NRC to reconsider the petitions based on the best available science. Please click here to support our lawsuit." So yeah, we'll include a link to this under the podcast when it goes up on Monday, because yeah, we got to change this, because I was reading just recently, they think in the last four decades, perhaps 50 million people died unnecessarily. I mean, is that exaggerated or is that possible?
I don't know what the number is, but a lot of people's lives can be prolonged if you can give low-dose treatments. Everybody's going to die, of course, but you want to give a good quality of life in old age. Mm-hmm. Especially for people with neurodegenerative diseases. And this can be done if we can optimize the treatment and get it accepted. But it's going to be difficult if people believe that any exposure to low-dose radiation is causing cancer and will not stimulate your protection systems.
Mm-hmm. So I really encourage people to go to that particular GoFundMe webpage, even if you only give a little bit. They're trying to get $150,000 so that they can launch a lawsuit. And I just checked recently and it's only about $5,000 now. So they're just starting really to gather enough money. So people really should check in there. Help sue NRC to end the use of the LNT model, a new GoFundMe campaign. Okay, so people really got to check that out.
Thank you.
Let me add, because Ed Calabrese has written a series of articles researching all the existing data going back into the 1920s and describing, Jerry, what you said earlier about the radiation on fruit flies, where he claimed there was a change when there was, in fact, a destruction. And he traced the fraud right from the 1920s to where Mueller actually got the Nobel Prize, and he lied in his Nobel Prize speech. And
there was a study that was done exactly a year before his speech, which showed that there was a threshold. And he saw the evidence, he knew it was right, and he ignored it or hid it, concealed it.
Wow.
Well, the point I want to make to the listeners is there is zero question in reality that the linear no threshold model is false, and that normally a single molecule of radiation will not cause cancer. And in fact, as we've been saying, the reverse is true. So we're not talking what our opinions are. The data is voluminous now to prove that the model is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, there was a lot of data before World War II. I mean, this has been going for 50, more than 50 years before they produced the radiation scare. And there was a lot of published data and books written about treatments that were done. But after they produced the scare, the doctors began to shun this whole idea. And they also moved over to using pharmaceuticals instead of low-dose radiation. And there's a financial reason for that, too, of course.
Oh, yeah, of course. That's a big driver for a lot of things, isn't it? I mean, it's interesting.
Follow the money.
Yeah, well, in the COVID case, I was reading that three of the top drug company executives have just joined Forbes' list of richest Americans. So, geez, here's another case that may be driven by, you know, people in the pharmaceutical industry making a fortune.
Well, the interesting thing is the company that's the foundation that's funding our study in Toronto, Apotex, is a pharmaceutical company.
Oh, well, they're honest. They're honest then.
Well, it's not. They built the hospital and the patients there. They were trying to do a very moral, ethical thing to build this hospital to look after these patients with Alzheimer's. And
yeah.
The fact that we treated the patients from there and they got better, others living there, their relatives want them to be treated. The company said, well, we have to do this. It's really ethical to find a cure, not a cure, but something that will remedy this disease so that, you know, if a patient can live home at home and talk with his relatives, then that's a much better quality of life than having him sit in an institution like a vegetable.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So this is something that's really very important, and it's hard to get this accepted because of the radiation scare.
Yeah, and I guess the radiation scare has impeded nuclear energy as well.
Of course, the cost.
Well, you know,
we have no idea what the cost to build a plant because it takes forever to build them.
Yeah, you mentioned the Lewis study of the people that were in close range with the bombs dropped on Japan in 1945. And that study, I think there were 70,000 people involved. And obviously,
There's two things. There was a study carried out on children, births.
Right.
After that, and that was a study that was done by Neil and Scholl. And they showed 70,000 children born from the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that showed no evidence of mutations, radiation-induced mutations. That's very strong evidence. And the National Academy of Science ignored that information and used fruit fly data.
Flood.
Then the other study with Lewis, that had to do with cancer, not mutations. And I reviewed that study in 2015. I wrote a paper about that, and I showed that this fellow had done the study improperly. He combined the data in different zones, a distance from ground zero, and what was showing as a threshold and a beneficial effect got blurred into a straight line, if you understand what I'm getting at.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, you know, we got to wrap up. That was really exciting. I mean, this is really groundbreaking, very important work. I encourage readers, look it up. Help sue NRC to end the use of the LNT model on the GoFundMe campaign. You know, you got to look it up because what we've been talking about today could save literally millions and millions of lives and improve the quality of life for millions more. So that was great, Dr. Cutler. So this is Tom Harris and Dr. Jay Lair signing out from the other side of the story.